how loud was the Big Bang? Will a black hole stop being a black hole if it loses enough mass? And why are we exploring Europa when Enceladus is much more interesting? All this and more in this week's Question Show. Welcome to the Question Show. Your questions, my answers. As always, wherever you are across my channel, if a question pops in your brain, just write it down. I will gather them up and I will answer them here. All right, let's get into the questions. Robert Anderson 5092. How loud was the Big Bang? When you first hear that question, you're going to think that's a nonsense question. How loud was the Big Bang? The Big Bang happened in space, and space is filled with vacuum, and sound doesn't travel in vacuum. And so even if the Big Bang was incredibly loud, there's no way to hear the sound of the Big Bang, right? That's what you're thinking. But actually, astronomers measure temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background radiation. And those temperature fluctuations correspond to sound waves that moved through the universe during, like within the first few moments after the universe formed, during the Big Bang. And so, you know, what we see today, when you look at a map of the cosmic microwave background radiation, you see these color variations, but that's not what astronomers are actually seeing. What they're measuring is temperature variations. And so on average, the cosmic microwave background is roughly 2.7 Kelvin. But when that light was emitted, it was more like the temperature of the surface of a red star. So like say in the 3,500 Kelvin range. But that is what has, those temperature variations are left over from earlier times when there were essentially sound waves moving through the universe that were compressing matter and making other regions a little bit less dense. And those temperature variations allow them to kind of measure. And then those temperature variations, they map onto the large scale structure of the universe. And so, you know, when you sort of think about waves moving across an ocean, there were these waves moving in the early universe, compressing matter, stretching it apart a little bit. And those waves corresponded to temperature variations in the cosmic microwave background radiation. And then later, those waves corresponded to where we see giant walls of galaxies and galaxy clusters and the voids in between. It's incredible. And so sound was traveling in the early universe. Now, it's not exactly sound as you would understand it. The human ear is not capable of measuring the kind of sound waves that were happening. They were like 200,000 light years long, these sound waves, and the human ear cannot handle sound waves that long. But if you sort of measure the energy level that's coming with those sound waves, it roughly corresponds to about 120 decibels, which is like the sound of a jet aircraft taking off nearby you. And so if you were in the universe when these sound waves were flowing around at the time of the Big Bang, you'd be experiencing that level of sound. Now, I want to give a huge shout out to Peter Coles, who's an astronomer. He has a blog called The Telescoper Blog, and he just wrote an incredible sort of detailed answer to this question, and I will provide a link in the show notes so you can check out more. I hope you noticed the Stargate planet name that appeared above my shoulder, and this is a way for you to vote, for you to tell us what you thought was the best question of the week. Now, unfortunately, our system messed up, and so I don't have the votes from last week, so we will figure out what the votes are next week, and we will celebrate it then. But we will put a new planet name above my shoulder throughout the entire episode, and then just go ahead and put the name that you thought was the best in the comments down below, and then we will count them up, and we will celebrate them next week, I hope, if the technology holds. Gocha M. If a black hole loses enough mass, won't it stop being a black hole and expand into a neutron star or something? Less gravity should mean light can escape once again, and imagine the fusion that could be happening under all that compression. No, once something turns into a black hole, it can never un-black hole. And, you know, it's not about the mass of the black hole, it's really about the density. That, you know, once you have compressed matter down to the point that it is the density of a black hole, once the event horizon forms that defines the point around the singularity where the escape velocity of this black hole has reached the speed of light, it's a one-way trip. You're never going to turn that thing into a not black hole. And people wonder, you know, if you slam two black holes into each other? Could they somehow tear each other apart and then not turn into black holes again? Nope. Just once it becomes a black hole, it can't go the other way. Now, this idea of evaporation, you know, we've been sort of talking about this for the last couple of weeks, that Hawking realized that black holes should be giving off, emitting radiation, and that would be sort of taking away the mass of the black hole. And eventually, black holes should decrease in mass. And, you know, there's a really interesting idea about primordial mass black holes, that, you know, there could have been, back to those, you know, we talked about those waves in that previous question, that there could be places where there were overdensities and underdensities, and maybe the overdensities were so dense that you got black holes forming in these regions of overdensity, of tons of different masses. And the way Hawking radiation works is that the less massive the black hole is, the hotter the radiation is coming off the black hole. We see its temperature as hotter. And that any black hole that has less than 100 million tons of mass should have evaporated since the beginning of the universe. And like, these black holes would be incredibly tiny. They would be the size of an atom, and yet they would have the mass 100 million tons. And I actually looked up, like, what is 100 million tons, and something that we can sort of wrap our minds around. And it is a quarter of the mass of all the human beings on Earth. So if you sort of imagine all the human beings, or if you took like 2.5 billion people and sort of put them all into one ball, that is 100 million tons. But imagine that amount of, but it is the size of an atom. And so with a black hole like that, or with any black hole, as they get lower and lower in mass, their radiation, the heat, the temperature of that black hole just increases. And so it moves through different wavelengths. And in the beginning, it's just putting out, you know, cool infrared, and then it moves into the visible scale, and you can actually see the thing bright, and then it moves into ultraviolet, and then into x-rays, and then gamma rays, and then the thing just disappears. One final blast of gamma radiation at the maximum temperature that it can reach, and then it's gone. And so, you know, black holes are going to move through that process. The most massively, you know, the ones that are 100 billion tons will slowly evaporate down until they have 1 billion tons, and then they have 1 million tons, and then they have 1,000 tons, and then they have 1 ton, and then they detonate as a final blast of gamma radiation. And you will never get this point where the black hole turns back into a neutron star. Apobathra. We're certain that Europa has a vast subsurface ocean, and even assume some water plumes might get ejected from beneath the ice into space. Europa Clipper will examine the plumes, and if the plumes are present, then might even analyze them. That's all fascinating, yet we know for sure that there are water plumes being ejected from beneath the surface of Enceladus. So why not send a probe to Enceladus instead and examine those water plumes directly? Is that much more expensive? Expense is definitely part of the issue, but also you just have to consider the timeline. So astronomers first discovered that Europa probably has an icy surface and some kind of subsurface ocean when NASA's Voyager spacecraft flew past Jupiter back in 1980. And then, because this was such an interesting place, they sent a follow-on mission called Galileo. And Galileo was sent in the 90s, and it wrapped up in the early 2000s. And they were able to take really great close-up pictures of the Galilean moons, try and, you know, were able to measure these cracks and interesting surface features on Europa. And in 1997, NASA started to pull together people to consider a mission to Europa, and they called it the Europa Orbiter. And then the work continued, and then a little into the 2000s, NASA's Cassini mission launched. And then Cassini made the long journey all the way out to Saturn, and about 10 years later, it got to Saturn and started to make these observations of Saturn and its moons. And around 2010, so like roughly the same time that the Cassini mission had arrived at Saturn, NASA started to seriously work on the design for the Europa Clipper mission. And this was based on a lot of other technology that had already been in the works. You think about the Juno spacecraft, which is at Jupiter right now, with its solar panels. And so they based a lot of the technology with that. And they were trying to figure out, you know, can we measure the depth down to the ice? Will we be able to find pockets of water underneath the surface of the ice? You know, a lot of really interesting scientific questions. And then as they were starting the design process of the Europa Clipper, the evidence started to come in that there were these tiger stripes at the bottom of Enceladus, that it was throwing its water ice out into space. And so the process just continued with the development of the Europa Clipper mission. They didn't sort of cancel that and go, no, we don't want to go to Europa. They still really want to go to Europa. There's a lot of really interesting questions to be had at Europa. And also, it is easier to get to, that Jupiter is closer, that the amount of sunlight that you're going to receive at Jupiter is significantly more than what you would get out at Saturn. And so with the Juno spacecraft, we learned that you can have solar panels. Yeah, they have to be 25 times as big as the solar panels that you would have here on Earth, but they work. And so they were able to build this flagship mission with the largest solar panel array ever built for an interplanetary probe, and continue that development process. And it's on its way to Europa now. But in the last decadal survey, this is where scientists come together and they agree on what are their requirements. They decided that the next thing that needs to come is an orbilander for Enceladus. And so on the next cycle, they're already starting. You know, I've already reported on various potential designs, ideas for missions on how you could go to Enceladus, how you could take advantage of being able to fly through the plumes, try to analyze them in situ. Like, could you put the right kind of chemistry lab on board this orbilander mission? Could you drop a lander right beside the tiger stripes so that it could actually sample the material as it's coming out of the surface of Enceladus? So there's a lot of great ideas, and that's the next cycle. So it's always this process of just moving on. So, you know, is it expense? Yeah, partly that it's a much more complicated, much more expensive mission with a very interesting sort of specific series of goals that you're trying to accomplish. And, you know, maybe they'll be able to continue on this using of bigger and bigger solar panels to be able to go to these farther destinations. I don't know offhand what, how much bigger they're going to have to be to go to Saturn, but I know people have done the math and it is theoretically possible. So be patient. Europa Clipper and the JUICE mission will give us a ton of information about the Jovian system. And then following after that will come the Enceladus Orbilander sometime in the, I don't know, 2060s or so. Roddy Piper, what would happen to an Earthling if you landed on a planet that spins the opposite way that the Earth spins? Absolutely nothing. Like I'm assuming you're talking about, like, if you had a planet that had exactly the same mass as the Earth and turned at the exact same speed that the Earth turns, just that it was turning in exactly the opposite direction, there would be effectively no difference. You wouldn't feel any physical difference. That it's about the length of the Earth day, the amount of time it takes for the Earth to turn once on its axis, that defines how long a day is and how long plants grow and your day-night cycles and all of that. And so if the Earth was turning backwards, it would all be identical. Now, there would be like larger climatic issues, like we would have winds blowing in the opposite directions because we have these cyclonic effects on the Earth. And so those would be flipped around. And so if you typically get your storms coming in from the west, you typically have your storms coming in from the east and so on. But in general, it would be pretty much identical. There's no difference in terms of the amount of gravity you would feel or anything. Toner Low, have we ever seen a globular cluster lose or gain a star over a length of time? So astronomers have measured the movements of stars in various globular clusters. And like globular clusters, these are ancient objects that are the remnants. They are probably the cores of dwarf galaxies that were stripped apart and consumed by the Milky Way and other galaxies. We have more than 100 of these globular clusters that are orbiting around the Milky Way, and they don't orbit around in the disk the way most of the stars in the galaxy do. They are orbiting in these orbits that take them around the outside in the halo of the galaxy. And so it's probably, you know, these galaxies came in at a funny angle, the Milky Way peeled away all of their outside stars, and the core remained and kind of glommed together into this globular cluster. And these things are old. These things are as ancient as the universe itself. They're 13 billion years old. And so they formed shortly, you know, or the galaxy that they formed in formed shortly after the beginning of the universe. And it's amazing that they've held together this long, but they're not completely invulnerable to damage. And in fact, you know, astronomers have measured, they think they've measured the first example of an intermediate mass black hole, something that has a black hole with thousands of times the mass of the sun, in one of these globular clusters. And they can actually measure the movements of stars, almost like in the wake of a black hole that's moving through or orbiting as part of one of these globular clusters. But you're going to get these three-body interactions where a couple of stars are going to get too close to each other and one is going to get kicked out. And there have been examples of stars that are clearly on escape trajectories leaving globular clusters. So over time, even the great globular clusters will eventually lose all of their stars. Discord moderator, what would a Mars car look like, or a moon car? You sort of imagine what kind of vehicle is required for the kind of terrain that you've got on the moon and Mars. And so we know that it's very, well, I mean, we have examples, of course, of moon cars that were already developed as part of the Apollo missions. They had these lunar buggies that the astronauts were able to get into and drive around on the surface of the moon. They looked like an open buggy that they could be in. And, you know, in terms of like the design issues, the gravity on the moon is 1/6 the gravity that is on the Earth. And so they can build these things out of very lightweight materials. They don't have to be as strong as an Earth car. And also, you know, they don't have to protect the passengers because they're probably not going to get into a car accident on the moon. And in fact, NASA has put out some contracts for people to develop vehicles that the Artemis astronauts will use in future missions. So not Artemis 3, but probably by Artemis 5 or so, they will be taking vehicles to the surface of the moon. And the ones that have been proposed look very similar to like a side-by-side. If you sort of imagine a juiced up quad with a roll cage that the astronauts can sit inside. And in a partnership with NASA and the Japanese Space Agency, Toyota is going to be building probably a larger lunar rover, something that has an actual atmosphere inside that can be pressurized. The astronauts can sit inside the vehicle with their shirt sleeves on and not have to wear a spacesuit and drive around on the surface of the moon for many days, maybe even weeks at a time. And so all of those ideas, all of that technology would work very well on Mars as well. But Mars has 1/3 the gravity of Earth, not 1/6 the gravity of the Earth. And so you wouldn't be able to build them out of such lightweight material. You'd have to make it a little stronger and a little beefier. And then the conditions on Mars are a little different than they are on the moon. When you think about the moon, you're in full sunlight, you're getting sort of very high temperatures, and then you go into permanent shadow for 2 weeks. And so you need to be able to have heaters that can keep the cockpit warm. On Mars, the temperature is not quite as bad. There's a little bit of air pressure, but you know, there are still a bunch of issues that you have to face. Visibility issues, driving on different kinds of regolith. So there'd be sort of minor design issues. But in general, the kinds of vehicles that are be planned for the Artemis missions will probably be very similar to what we see on Mars. If you want to support the work we do at Universe Today, consider joining our Patreon club. Your support lets us have a minimum of ads and no sponsorship messages. Patrons get no ads on universetoday.com for life. Want the extra parts of the live stream that aren't in this edited version? You can sign up for a special patron-only podcast feed and get the overtime segments as well as other special behind-the-scenes episodes, including our monthly patron-only question show. Thanks to everyone who has already subscribed and welcome to our recent newcomers, Mike Wharton, Andre Jaffe, Tom Roseland, Aaron Wilson, Joe Hollestein, Carl Merrill, Mark Sager, John Ciccone, Marius, Biker V. James, Pete Harris, and Jeff Owaziek. Join the club at patreon.com/universetoday. Bobby Reynolds, if Ganymede and Titan are bigger than Mercury, can they be considered planets? I mean, we're in this weird place where people are still arguing over the definition of the planet. A lot of people are pretty mad at the International Astronomical Union's demotion of Pluto. And so there's a really interesting case to be made that really any object that has reached hydrostatic equilibrium, something that has enough mass and gravity to pull itself into a sphere, then it could be classified as a planet. And Ganymede and Titan absolutely fulfill that requirement. In fact, there's about 125 objects in the solar system that have been found so far that have enough gravity that they've pulled themselves into a sphere. And then you have a lot of objects that don't have that amount of mass, and so they're not spheres, and so they're not planets. And so one perfectly reasonable classification system is that there are 125 planets in the solar system. Now, if you had children have to learn all 125 planet names, they might not be appreciative when they're in elementary school, but it'd be good for them, I think. It's worth it. So, I mean, the bottom line to this whole thing about whether something's a planet or not a planet or anything, it just doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Each of these objects are amazing worlds on their own, that they don't need anyone to tell them that they are or aren't planets, that someone can be the arbiter of how amazing they are. And when you think about the kinds of exoplanets that we're going to be starting to discover out there across the universe, we're going to need a better definition or no definition for what a planet is. So I think this, you know, this whole idea of planets, man, it's turning into a rant. This whole idea of planets came from us only knowing that there were six objects that we could see in the sky and under our feet, right? Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Okay, seven things, six plus Earth, and then the sun and the moon. And for tens of thousands of years, that's all we knew. And then a thing that was even bigger than many of the planets that we already knew of, Uranus, was discovered. And people said, okay, well, obviously that's a planet. And then they found another one saying, well, obviously that's a planet. And then they found a whole bunch of small things around all of these planets. And then they found all the Kuiper Belt objects. And so it's a mess. Don't worry about it. Just enjoy the worlds for what they are. Dougal, how loud would the sun be if space could propagate sound? So in this case, yeah, we absolutely can't hear the sun because there is no atmosphere between us and the sun to propagate the sound. But if there was, say, water or air in between us and the sun, well, the surface of the sun is bubbling and boiling and frothing, and you've got pockets of material that are rising and falling, and it would actually be incredibly loud. It would be between 100 and 150 decibels from here. So in other words, if there was atmosphere between us and the sun, then all you would hear would just be the sun just screaming, screeching, shouting nonstop. So I'm kind of glad that we don't have an atmosphere between us and the sun to hear that nonsense. Ian Matthews, a lot of countries are starting to use lasers for their missile defense systems. Do you think these systems could be adapted to send solar sails? That feels like a great opportunity. So one of the best ideas for being able to send a spacecraft on an interstellar mission is with a laser sail. So you take this incredibly powerful laser, you fire it at this solar sail that has a tiny little spacecraft attached to it, and the laser is accelerating the solar sail at 10% the speed of light, 20% the speed of light, and then it coasts, and as it flies through some other planetary system, takes a bunch of pictures, sends them home, and we get those first ever images of another star system. And this idea is breakthrough starshot or laser sailing. You know, there's been a lot of ideas and talk about this. And it depends on a bunch of technology that really just doesn't exist today. And so one of these is the solar sail fabric, that you need something that you can hit with an incredibly powerful laser that can withstand the amount of energy that is being sort of transferred onto it and not just melt. That you need to be able to have components and electronics that can be miniaturized to the point that they could be the payload for this tiny sail, but not like make it too hard to accelerate. But the other half of this question is the laser. And we know that our current lasers are strong. And I don't remember what the exact strength of the lasers are today, but there is sort of a smooth growth in the strongest lasers that have ever been done. But we are still many orders of magnitude away from the strength of the lasers that would be required to send spacecraft to other star systems. But there are lots of other reasons why people are developing stronger and stronger lasers. And you mentioned this, military. What a surprise. The military is coming up with powerful lasers. And so you can imagine that as the military develops lasers that are more powerful, that they can zap missiles and cause them to explode or you know, who knows what they're going to use them for, attach them to their space warships and fight space battles around the Earth, fighting off the alien invasion. I don't know. But as they develop these more and more powerful lasers, then they will have practical applications in things that aren't fighting and war and so on. One of the most interesting applications in my mind is actually removing space debris. You know, the idea of space debris comes up a lot here on the channel. People always ask the question, why don't they just go and gather up all that space debris and bring it back home to Earth or gather it into a pile and recycle it or use it as a junkyard that future missions can use? Well, the problem is that every single piece of space junk is on its own trajectory and it is traveling at tens of thousands of kilometers per hour. And that the only way for you to be able to get that space junk is to launch a spacecraft that can chase it down, grab onto it. And maybe that makes sense if you've got a giant booster rocket that's orbiting around the Earth and it's just going to cause mayhem down the road. Yeah, send a rocket, chase it down, grab the booster, deorbit with it together. But there are hundreds of thousands of pieces of space junk. What do you do for the piece of metal that is a centimeter across that if it hit an asteroid, if it hit a spacecraft, it could destroy it? And there are hundreds of thousands of those. Lasers. And so the best idea for removing space junk is you put these powerful lasers in orbit that are zapping bits of space junk as they fly by. And then that zap vaporizes a little bit of material on the surface of the piece of space junk. And that if you time things right, you're essentially deorbiting all of this space junk. And one laser could just watch the sky and as bits of space debris are coming by, it just zaps them all. And over time, the debris will act like little rockets to bring itself back down into the Earth's atmosphere. And a few lasers positioned around the Earth could remove a lot of the space junk. And really, I think it's the only practical idea. And yet that technology of being able to zap and bring down space debris, you're going to need very powerful lasers that are capable of operating in space. And so it's a very similar technology to the kinds of lasers that you're going to need for sending the Breakthrough Starshot mission. So I think, you know, we're going to see the application of lasers in space for cleaning up space debris. And as they make these things more and more powerful, then we're going to see more and more applications. People are going to say, well, could we use this for a laser sail? Let's give it a try. And so I think that's the way we follow down that technology. Critical mass 22. I understand it's very hard for a mass to actually fall into a black hole. What is the process and how long can it take for a mass to finally cross the event horizon? So I think you're confusing a couple of concepts here that I should just sort of separate for you in your mind. So you have heard correctly that from an outside perspective, watching someone fall into a black hole, it takes them an infinite amount of time to cross the event horizon. And that is because the incredible gravitational forces around the black hole cause enough time dilation that from your perspective as an outside observer, you don't see them actually cross the event horizon. You know, we talked about this last week or 2 weeks ago, the astronaut falls to the black hole and then slows down as they get closer and closer to the surface of the black hole. You're watching them and they appear to pause on the event horizon of the black hole and then they just fade away. They redshift and they fade away. From the perspective of the astronaut, it is a smooth journey that they fall to the black hole. They are torn apart by the intense tidal forces. They are spaghettified and they then go cross into the event horizon. And for the most massive black holes, they may not even get spaghettified. You could fly your spacecraft right into a black hole, like a supermassive black hole, and not even experience any tidal forces. You wouldn't even notice, but now you're trapped. You're never going to be able to get away from the black hole. And maybe you run into the black hole itself immediately. Maybe you have to make your journey down to whatever is the singularity. We don't know what goes on inside the event horizon of the black hole. But even from the outside observer, as someone falls into a black hole, their mass is added to the mass of the black hole essentially immediately. And that is because the event horizon of the black hole grows as it adds new mass. Essentially, the event horizon rises to meet the new mass that is falling into the black hole. You don't see it as an outside observer, but this process is happening. And so even from an outside observer, we are watching that mass. And we think about it, like, this is the way it has to be. I mean, we see black holes out there with 10 times the mass of the sun, ones with a million times the mass of the sun, ones with a billion times the mass. Like, how did they get so massive? They had to have been continuously feeding in times that aren't so time dilated out to infinity. And so from an outside observer, you can measure the increase of mass as someone falls into a black hole. I mean, you probably can't measure that directly, but maybe, you know, as a star falls into a black hole, you can measure the increase in mass from that. But you wouldn't see it disappear into the event horizon. You would see it redshifted and time dilated to forever. Lily Rose, how do we predict the lifetime of stars? So it's pretty tricky to look at one star and try to figure out how long that star is going to survive if you didn't see any other examples. But the trick is, if there's one thing we can see a lot of out there, it is stars. And so we can look at stars in every single stage of evolution. And we could see stars that are absolutely brand new just moments after bringing in all of the gas and dust to begin as a protostar. We can see examples of stars that have moved to a further stage where they're starting to get this gravitational collapse inside of them. They're heating up. We can see examples where fusion has truly begun in the core. We can see examples for stars that are putting out sort of larger amounts of energy. And we can see stars that have reached the end of their lives and are bloating up as red giants. We see every single example in between. And we see those examples for different masses of stars. We see how young red dwarfs behave as they're very tempestuous in their early years and putting out a lot of megaflares. We see how ultra-massive stars turn into blue supergiants, red supergiants over time. So, you know, it's very difficult to imagine and predict the future of any one individual star, but because we have literally trillions of examples that we can look at, we can, you know, even in the Milky Way, you know, we have 200 billion stars that we can look at as examples, and you can start to get a real sense of how things tend to happen over time. The really interesting, and I did an interview about this fairly recently, about this idea of astroseismology, that for the longest time, figuring out the age of a star, like where is a star in its sort of larger cycle from birth to death, it's actually pretty tricky. You know, if you could ask someone, like, what is the age of that star? It's within a few billion years, you could make an estimate for how old it is. But in the last couple of decades, a whole new science has opened up called astroseismology. And this was pioneered with the sun. So astronomers were able to see these waves moving across the surface of the sun, and that allowed them to probe the interior of the sun in the same way that seismic waves on Earth allow us to see what is inside the Earth, measure the different layers inside our planet. And so based on that, astronomers were able to calculate the age of the sun based on the thicknesses of the different layers inside the sun and map that against the known age of the sun thanks to the meteorites that have been found here on Earth. And then they've been able to do this astroseismology on other star systems. In fact, the TESS mission, which is largely a planet hunter, but actually is so sensitive, or has such a sensitive photometer on board, that it's able to measure slight changes on the brightness coming from a star, and they're able to measure these ripples on other stars. And then from those ripples, they're able to do a very accurate measurement of the age of the star. And so in the last really decade, astronomers have mastered figuring out how old stars are just by looking at them. Mouse destruction. Could we send mass to space to change our orbit and stop global warming? Unfortunately, if you removed mass from planet Earth, you wouldn't change your orbit. And so, like, think about that classic experiment where astronauts were on the surface of the moon and they dropped a feather and they dropped a hammer, and they found that the feather and the hammer dropped at the same speed. Was it Galileo was on the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and he did that same experiment where he dropped rocks of different weights and found that they landed at the same time. And so if that, those experiments, it's essentially the same thing, which is that you are taking planet Earth, you are giving Earth less mass, but it's still going to orbit the sun at the same rate. And that's because the orbit of the Earth has nothing to do with the mass of the Earth. Well, it has a tiny little bit to do with the mass of the Earth, but roughly, you know, really depends on the mass of the sun. And that's why we have asteroids that orbit around us, sort of nearby, on roughly the same orbit as the Earth does. And so removing mass from the Earth wouldn't change the Earth's orbit. But, you know, you're trying to see, is there some ways that we can limit global warming by changing the orbit of the Earth? And theoretically, sure, yeah, you could change the orbit of the Earth so that if the Earth was orbiting a little farther away from the sun, then you would be experiencing less heat coming from the sun. And so the Earth would build up less temperature and you could counteract global warming. But the problem is that if you did this sort of temporary fix, then if we got our climate emissions under control, then now the Earth would be a little too far away from the sun and the Earth would get very, very cold. And so it probably doesn't make sense to change the climate. Now, that said, the sun is heating up, and over the next 900 million to 2 billion years, this number has changed thanks to new calculations. The sun will heat up to the point that it'll boil the oceans on the Earth, all life will die, and the planet Earth will be uninhabitable. And the way that you could get around that, and it would be sort of the same solution for your global warming problem, is that you would want to move the Earth. So the way you would move the Earth is you would have asteroids do flybys and do gravitational slingshots around the Earth. Each time one of these asteroids did a gravitational slingshot, it would change the Earth's orbit just a tiny little bit, move it a little bit farther away from the sun. You'd have to sort of circularize it. It gets kind of complicated. But the gist is, if you could have asteroids fly by the Earth very close, not quite hit the Earth, then you could slowly move the Earth's orbit farther and farther away from the sun. And you would only have to have one of these asteroids come by every 10,000 years or so, and you would continuously be moving the Earth outward as the sun is heating up, keep our temperature nice and balanced, and we could survive until the sun finally does die as a red giant star. All right, those were all the questions that we had this week. Thank you, everyone, who asked your questions in the YouTube comments, and thank you, everybody, who showed up for the live show. We do this show every Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific time. It is 2 hours long. And so the part that you're watching is just the first 45 minutes that has been edited down, but it's a whole extra hour. So if you want the full experience, come join us, which should be a notification for when the next show is going to happen here on the channel. Now, I'm going to talk about ways that you can access all of our content. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew Gross, Barry Lake Roofing, David Giltonen, David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Rohrbach, ScienceWorldRecord.org, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Fowler Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So I notice people are putting together playlists of the unlisted videos that we do here on the channel. And so, you know, after every live stream, we put the 2-hour episode, we make it unlisted, and then we will edit it down and cut it up and use it for various pieces for different things that we do. And so people have got these playlists going. And also people complain that they don't like to see ads here on YouTube. Not everybody has YouTube Premium. And sometimes you're going to have to sort of watch an ad before the episode begins. Now, we have solved all of these problems for you, and we've made this all completely free. Free. You don't have to pay any money. You can get access to the full unedited live stream. You can get access to every single video that we release publicly without any ads on it. And all you have to do is go to Patreon. And you don't have to sign up. You don't have to give us any money. You don't have to put in your credit card. Well, I don't know if Patreon makes you put in your credit card. But anyway, you don't have to pledge any money to us. All you have to do is just go to patreon.com/universetoday. And then there's like the default thing to do on Patreon is that you can follow us. And so once you follow us, then whenever we post a new video, we upload the video to Patreon. And so you will get a notification by email that says we have our new video, and then you can just watch it. You can watch it in the Patreon app. You can watch it on the browser, and there's no ads. But then also, every time we post the question show, I put a link to the full unedited live stream right there on the post. And so then you can just watch that. And so you don't have to go and like hunt for it and find these secret playlists here on YouTube. They're, we make it all available to you. But then if you do go the step further and become a patron, of course, then you get to participate in the monthly patrons only question show where we put out the call to all the patrons to give us their comments and questions. And we answer them all, no matter how long it takes us. And this month's episode was like 3.5 hours long. But also, we pull out the audio for the overtime segments of our shows. We make those available in a special patron-only podcast feed that you can access. So there's a lot of additional material, but just like a lot of stuff available completely for free. And I think, you know, like a lot of people, they tell me, oh, I used to watch your videos and then YouTube algorithm just stopped showing your videos and I rediscovered you. Don't let your media consumption be dictated to you by an algorithm, by a robot. You decide what you want to watch. And what you want to watch is more space news from Universe Today. All right, we'll see you next week.